Welcome. I am presenting today a topic on without notice injunctions or without notice applications. What is a without notice application? These used to be called ex parte applications back in the day when Latin was still permissible in English courts and procedures. These applications are an exception to the basic principle that no orders should be made against a party without the party having had a chance or an opportunity to be heard. The concept of an application being with or without notice is not the same as on paper or at a hearing. So, for example, a without notice application can be on paper or it can be made by way of an oral hearing. When can a without notice application be made? The court will only entertain a without notice application if it appears to the court that there are good reasons, as set out in the CPR, for not giving notice. For example, if there is an exceptional urgency, and the courts have previously held that mere urgency is not enough, and there must be an exceptional urgency for a without notice order to be granted. For example, when there is a risk of dissipation of assets. The overriding objective must be furthered by granting such a without notice application. So granting refraining from giving notice may defeat the purpose of the applicant's interests. And these are situations such as search orders or freezing injunctions when a court may be amenable to granting a without notice application. They can also be matters of procedure. For example, a foreign party needs to be served, but because they have not been served, therefore they're not on notice. And the applicant can come before the court to seek permission to serve them in the foreign jurisdiction, or permission to serve a party in a foreign or indeed within the English jurisdiction by alternate means. Without it for default judgments. This is when a party may have been served but has not filed an acknowledgement of service. Then there are situations which have cropped up in the recent past, such as cyber security issues or cyber theft, where it is the identity of the defendant is not known. And therefore, the court has been willing to grant an order against persons unknown. And this would necessarily have to be on a without notice basis. And it is only when such orders are served on, for example, the bank, that a bank would be willing to reveal the identity of the fraudster. And the last situation in which a without notice application can be brought is when the other side is not yet on the court record. Again, this is a matter of simple procedure. For example, a claim has been filed. It has not been served because the CPR grants 4 months within which it must be served. But it has been unable to be served within the 4 months for a number of reasons. And the claimant is back at court just seeking a simple extension of the claim form. I thought it would be useful to cover three types of without notice applications. Permission to serve outside the jurisdiction. The second, permission to serve by alternate means. And lastly, freezing injunctions. Taking each in turn, permission to serve outside the English jurisdiction. This is a common without notice application and is brought in situations when the defendant is located outside the English jurisdiction and has not agreed to be governed by, so the contract is not governed by either English law, or the contract does not say that the English courts have jurisdiction. In such a circumstance, the claimant must bring a without notice application for permission to serve the foreign defendant outside the jurisdiction. This is necessary because the English courts wish to supervise the exercise of their powers over foreign defendants. And it is sensible to regulate whether or not a foreign party must be brought within the English fold. courts would tend to grant this only when there is a sufficient connection with England. And there are strict rules that govern circumstances in which an English court would be willing to bring a foreign defendant within its fold. The first is that the claimant or the applicant must prove that it has a good arguable case and that the claim falls within one of the jurisdictional gateways in the CPR. There are about 20 jurisdictional gateways. For example, one of them is that there has been a contract and a breach of contract has occurred within the English jurisdiction. That is sufficient to grant on the English English court's jurisdiction to hear the dispute. The claimant, however, needs to go further and also prove that it has a good arguable case. Many of you may know that this used to be the better of the argument, but it has, since the Supreme Court decision of Brownlee and Four Seasons, changed to plausible evidential basis. And therefore, an applicant bringing a without notice application for permission to serve outside the jurisdiction will need to prove on a plausible evidential basis that they have a good arguable case. The claimant must also show that there is a serious issue that needs to be tried. For example, if there is a bank in the English jurisdiction and a borrower in a foreign jurisdiction who has defaulted on payments under the loan agreement or the facility agreement, there is a serious issue to be tried. Lastly, the claimant must show that the English jurisdiction is clearly or distinctly the most appropriate forum to resolve the dispute. There are two exceptions when a claimant does not need to seek permission to serve English proceedings on a foreign party. And this is when a contract or an agreement expressly confers jurisdiction on the English courts. And the second is when the contract or the agreement provides for a service agent clause within the English jurisdiction. This is a clause that would usually say that both parties or perhaps the foreign party must provide and maintain a service agent within the English jurisdiction to receive and accept court proceedings or legal documents as they may as is required from time to time. Now, in an interesting case that I was involved in, the service agent agreement had expired and the foreign party notified the English party that the service agent agreement has actually expired. A year passed, nothing happened, and typically the English claimant served proceedings on the service agent about a year after they had been notified that the service agent was no longer engaged. Mr. Justice Popplewell, as he then was, took the view that service was effective because even though the agency agreement had expired and the agency was no longer valid, the foreign party continued to have an obligation under contract to maintain a service agent in the UK. If they didn't, that was a matter for them. But service on the English service agent was good and effective service. The second without notice application that I would like to speak about briefly is permission to serve by alternate means. This is under CPR 6.15. After obtaining permission to serve outside the jurisdiction, obviously the claimant or the applicant must actually serve the respondent. Now, this is not as easy or straightforward as one would imagine in international matters. Most countries around the world, including the UK, are a signatory to what is known as the Hague Convention on Service Abroad. And if the foreign party is located in one of those countries, which is a signatory to the Hague Convention on Service, then service must only be carried out in accordance with provisions of the Hague Convention. Now, a number of countries around the world, such as, for example, Turkey, India, etc., several countries, have opted out of what is known as Article 10 of the Hague Convention on Service. And Article 10 prevents, Article 10 allows service by electronic means, and those countries that have opted out of this are trying to protect their citizens from service by email. And in those circumstances, an English party or a claimant, whether or not they are an English party, would need to serve in accordance with the historic snail mail, as we used to call it. So for example, a country would have nominated its Ministry of Law as the agent to receive all of the documents and claim form and particulars of claim and so on. And then they would, within the country, within its own domestic network, serve the defendant through their own domestic means. Now, in a situation such as this, sometimes a claimant can be lucky and service can be effected in accordance with the Hague Convention pretty quickly. But sometimes it can take far too long, 8 months, perhaps in excess of a year, just to effect service under the Hague Convention. And in these situations, a claimant tends to get impatient and go to the English court and say, please, can you grant me permission to serve this foreign defendant by alternate means, such as by email? Sometimes, and I have been involved in cases where the judges grant permission to serve by email, but on the return date, a defendant can promptly come back and say they could not actually have been served by email because they were resident in a country that had opted out of Article 10 of the Hague Convention on Service, and therefore that service can be set aside. It is therefore important to consider all means of service before going to an English court and seeking permission to serve by alternate means. The last type of without notice application that I would like to consider is a freezing injunction. This is also known, or it used to be known, as a Mareva injunction, and it restrains a party from removing assets that are within the English jurisdiction. If it is a worldwide freezing injunction, it can also refrain a party or prevent it from dealing with assets located outside the English jurisdiction. It also would tend to direct the party, the defendant, to provide a number of pieces of information, such as a list of assets, of all of their assets worldwide, and that this must be provided on an affidavit within a certain number of time, usually 3 days to 7 days within grant of the freezing injunction. English courts are not the only courts that tend to grant worldwide freezing injunctions. The DIFC courts in Dubai are also amenable to grant a without notice injunction by way of a freezing injunction. Now, there are certain duties that an applicant for a freezing injunction, or indeed an application at any without notice application, must follow. And these are in the next slide. If we may please turn to the slide that says duties at a without notice hearing. Thank you very much. The first duty that an applicant as well as their solicitors have is the duty of full and frank disclosure. At any without notice hearing, an applicant must come to the court with clean hands, and this is demonstrated by carrying out the duty of full and frank disclosure, which is judged at a very high standard. The principle is quite simple. At a without notice hearing, the court is only reliant on the party before it. It doesn't have the opportunity to hear the party that is not present, and therefore it is relying on the information that the applicant puts before it. In such circumstances, it is necessary to present both the facts as well as the law in full to the judge at a without notice hearing. Some key principles include the disclosure of all matters, legal and factual, including matters that are adverse to one's own case, such as a potential defense that may be available to the respondent. And this is important because the judge will need to decide whether or not the applicant before it has a good arguable case before it grants the without notice application. The applicant must also disclose all facts known to the applicant, including those facts that could have properly been known had inquiries been made. The duty of full and frank disclosure is a continuing duty. So, for example, if a claimant has come before the English court and has been successful in getting a without notice order, and then goes off and perhaps files a parallel proceeding or a related proceeding in a foreign jurisdiction, then they must come back and disclose this foreign proceeding to the English judge, because the duty of full and frank disclosure is a continuing duty. This is, as I said previously, judged at a high level or a high standard. And in one of my cases called PNB and Srinivasan, I appeared for a foreign defendant who was a borrower and defaulter under an English law governed facility agreement, where the loan had been disbursed by an English bank. The English bank had brought these proceedings at the very end of the limitation period, such that by the time we were before the court on the return date, limitation had expired. One of our contentions was that the English bank had not come to the court with clean hands and had not fulfilled its duty of full and frank disclosure, because after it had obtained the freezing injunction, it had gone off and it filed a case both in America as well as in India, and had not bothered to notify the court of either of these two proceedings. Chief Master Marsh held at paragraph 88 that there was plainly a duty not just to bring the existence of the foreign proceedings against the defendants to the attention of the court, but also to explain their scope and how they interrelated with the claim before the English court. On appeal, Chancellor Voss upheld this and further held that the failure to disclose the foreign proceedings was a serious breach, and that the claimant's culpability in relation to the duty of full and frank disclosure should be judged at a high level. Now, this meant pretty severe consequences for the English bank, because they were outside limitation. Despite this, the order was set aside, although Chancellor Voss did indicate that in certain circumstances, it may be possible to reinstate the order in the interests of justice and deal with the injustice to the defendant in relation to the breach of full and frank disclosure by way of costs. He did, however, add that reinstating an order should be exercised sparingly. The jurisdiction to set aside is meant to be penal in nature. And the fact that a judge may have made the order anyway is of little importance. In other words, an attempt in balancing the strength of an underlying claim is to take away the public policy objective of the principle of full and frank disclosure at a without notice application. An applicant is also under a duty to provide an undertaking in damages, so that any loss that may be suffered by the respondent as a result of the without notice order is compensable. When seeking an order without notice, the applicant is therefore required not only to furnish an undertaking in damages, but very often to fortify this undertaking in damages as well. The applicant is also under a duty to draft the terms of the order carefully and as narrowly as possible, such that there is minimal interference with the respondent's rights. The order must also be valid only for a limited period specified in the order, and must specify also a return date on which parties may be back in court to and the respondent may have an opportunity to have the order set aside. Following the grant of an order, the applicant has a duty to serve promptly. It must serve the court order, the application notice, any evidence in support, etc. But also, the applicant must serve a hearing note. For example, if a solicitor was present in court taking down handwritten or now typed notes, those notes are not protected by legal professional privilege and need to be disclosed to the respondent, because the respondent needs to know what exactly occurred in court on that date. On the return date, the defendant may apply to set aside the without notice application. I have found in my experience that the most common or the usual way to be successful in setting aside a without notice application is a breach of full and frank disclosure, and we have discussed this at length. It is sometimes also possible to argue that the claimant or the applicant did not have a good arguable case. It can also be said in cases of a freezing injunction that there was no risk of dissipation of assets, and therefore the freezing injunction need not have been granted. And with that, I come to an end of my bit, and this is where, Samar, I hand over to you.
Thank you very much for that tour de force through a very, very complicated area of law. I will hopefully deal with something that's a bit easier than the traps that people get themselves into when they are making applications with no opponents. One finds that it's the trickiest application is when you don't have an opponent and you have to put their case fairly and fully and frankly before the court. You wouldn't have been arguing your position if you thought that they had a very good case, but there you have to do it, and you have to do it, as Karishma says, fully and frankly. And if you don't, you might get yourself and your clients in trouble at the return date and beyond. What I wanted to talk about today was a topic which is very different in that you will almost always have this as an inter-parties application. And it relates to anti-suit injunction and anti-suit relief. Now, what is anti-suit relief? It is, at its core, an order by the court restraining a party from proceeding in another forum. Now, this forum could be another court in another jurisdiction, or it could be a court full stop, if the parties have agreed to an arbitration agreement. And if we could look at the first slide, which is a nice little quote from Nori Holding and Public Joint Stock Company Bank Otkriti. Effectively, the idea behind this form of relief is that where parties agree to arbitrate, it is the policy of the law that they should be held to their bargain. Now, Nori Holding is a case where there was an arbitration agreement. As I said, my focus will be on anti-suit relief granted in favor of arbitration agreements. But there is the possibility of anti-suit relief granted in favor of other court proceedings as well, which is a similar but different topic, but which we're not covering today. My focus today will be on the conceptual and practical points arising under the question of how do we get an order of the court to restrain a party from going to a court in breach of an arbitration agreement. So we could look at the next slide, which is entitled Court's Power to Grant Anti-Suit Injunction. We see two prongs, and it's not always as clear cut as domestic arbitration versus foreign seated arbitration, in that the court's powers can, as we will see shortly, go beyond what the strict statutory scheme provides, but it is a good framework to keep in mind as a starting point. When you're dealing with a domestic arbitration where Section 9 of the English Arbitration Act is engaged, which, by the way, as those of you who practice arbitration will know, is a mandatory provision of the English Arbitration Act, it is a relatively straightforward route where, under Section 9 sub 1, a party to an arbitration agreement against whom legal proceedings have been brought may apply to the English court to stay proceedings, insofar as they concern matters which under the agreement should have been referred to an arbitration. And then under Section 9 sub 4, the court may not refuse such an application unless it is satisfied that the arbitration agreement is void, inoperative, or incapable of being performed. So you will see that the language here, which is replicated from the language of the Act itself, is quite clear that there's no question of discretion when the requirements of Section 9 are engaged, as long as the arbitration agreement is persisting invalid, i.e. it is not void, inoperative, or incapable of being performed, the court will grant the application, and in that sense it is akin to enforcement under the New York Convention, where the English court has now got an obligation as a matter of domestic law, which is also part of international public policy, say, well, you know, we will grant such applications if these requirements are met. When you're dealing with proceedings abroad, the matters can be a bit more complicated, as we will see in the next slide and beyond. Consider a scenario where court proceedings have been commenced in two or three different jurisdictions, but there's in fact an arbitration agreement which is valid. Now, the first point to bear in mind is that anti-suit relief is a substantive remedy as opposed to merely a procedural one. It can have an actual effect to the party's substantive rights. It's not just a step that you take. The conceptual basis of this is, as we saw in the previous slide, the court will hold the parties to their bargain and the negative obligation not to start proceedings elsewhere, the court will hold them to it. Now, it is often said, and those who do not perhaps practice this area of law might wonder why the English court has power over a foreign court. Well, the answer is it doesn't. The anti-suit injunction is not directed against the foreign court itself, but against the party which is proceeding within that foreign court or which is threatening to proceed in that forum. And the case, the leading authority on that is Société Nationale from 1987. Now, the traditional approach, because that is the premise and that is the conceptual basis, the traditional approach as a part of the ITF committee has always been that because these injunctions may have an indirect effect on foreign courts, obviously you're effectively saying to a party which is appearing before a foreign court, well, you should not appear before that foreign court, or you should withdraw your action against that foreign court. Because these injunctions may have an indirect effect, a cautious approach was adopted by English courts out of concerns for comity, etc. Now, the modern approach is different and less cautious. The leading case on that is the Cummingos case from 2013, where the Supreme Court said, the time has now come to lay aside the ritual incantation that this is a jurisdiction which should only be exercised sparingly and with great caution, effectively saying that the anti-suit injunctions should be granted on the simple and clear ground that the defendant has promised not to bring these other proceedings. So the modern approach of the English court is to say, well, you know, if you, party B, have brought proceedings against party A in breach of an arbitration agreement, even though we respect the foreign court, we will restrain you, party B, from being in breach of your arbitration agreement with party A. And party A's application will therefore be granted. Now, The modern approach, therefore, looking at the next slide, is that it emphasizes the contractual nature of the arbitration agreements and characterizes the anti-suit injunction as a remedy for a breach of contract for which damages would manifestly be inadequate. So arbitration agreements, as you may know, are seen as agreements in and of themselves, and it is a breach of that agreement to arbitrate that the English court is saying, well, we will injunct you from acting in breach of it, because obviously if you have proceedings going on in another court for years and years and years, well, damages are not often adequate remedy for the trouble that you've had to go through in another court when parties had agreed to an arbitration with all its advantages and, for instance, privacy and confidentiality, etc. But what the court will require is a high degree of probability that there is a valid arbitration agreement which governs the dispute in question to which the respondent is a party. The recent authorities on this are Ecobank Transactional and also Michael Wilson Partners and Emmett. So one from 2015, the other from 2018, both from the Court of Appeal. So the court, the English court will need to be satisfied of the likelihood of the validity of the arbitration agreement. Now, obviously, if it's a good and well drafted arbitration agreement, this will not be a high threshold. But often, arbitration agreements, known familiarly as midnight clauses, have and can have these sorts of issues. But the court will need to be satisfied with a high degree of probability that, on the whole, the arbitration agreement is one that is likely to be A, valid, and B, govern the dispute in question to which the respondent is a party. However, as with all injunctions and other equitable remedies, it is within the court's discretion in all cases in which it appears to the court to be just and convenient to grant the injunction or not. And so there's a high discretion that the court has. Now, as I said, because of the strong public policy in enforcing arbitration agreements in the English court's approach towards them, the likely position, the starting presumption is that the court will grant the anti-suit relief which is sought. However, there is a residual discretion. In practice, what the court will require is strong reasons to displace the starting point that an anti-suit injunction should be granted. So we go on now to examine what the strong reasons test is, and we look at the next slide. The test that is often used is from a House of Lords case from 2001 called Donoghue and Armco. And the extract that you can see on this slide, which I'll read out slowly, is: if contracting parties agree to give a particular court exclusive jurisdiction to rule on claims between those parties, and a claim falling within the scope of the agreement is made in proceedings in a forum other than that which the parties have agreed, the English court will ordinarily exercise its discretion to secure compliance with the contractual bargain, unless the party suing in the non-contractual forum, the burden being on him or it, can show strong reasons for suing in that forum. Whether a party can show strong reasons sufficient to displace the other party's prima facie entitlement to enforce the contractual bargain will depend on all the facts and circumstances of the particular case. Now, Donoghue was a case, as I said at the very outset, of a case where the anti-suit injunction wasn't sought in favor of an arbitration agreement, but it was in favor of an exclusive jurisdiction clause and exclusive jurisdiction of the court clause. And the English court said, if you go to another court when you have agreed to go to one court, you better have strong reasons to show it. Now, the important point here is it is for the party suing in the other forum to show that there are strong reasons for doing so. And this policy moves both from the exclusive jurisdiction of a particular court type cases, which is what Donoghue was, and applies equally to exclusive arbitration agreement type cases, which is what we're concerned with today. Now, what constitutes strong reasons, as the court said, will depend on all the facts and circumstances of the case. So this is a fact-specific inquiry. But we can see some of the sort of examples of strong reasons if we look at the next slide. Donoghue itself concerned a case where the court was concerned with the question of whether the ends of justice would be best served by a single composite trial in the only forum in which a single composite trial can be procured. So, for instance, if you have issues which relate to a number of jurisdictions, but one jurisdiction, even if it is a jurisdiction which goes beyond the exclusive jurisdiction agreement, is the one where, practically speaking, justice would be served by having a single composite trial, the court might say, well, we will go, we will allow that to proceed. But that is a rare case. It often happens, on this slide, is that the real question really is, are there other parties whose interests might be engaged? So an arbitration agreement might be between two parties, but there might be interests of other parties. For instance, people who are creditors in an insolvency type scenario in a particular jurisdiction. And it may well be that their interests and those creditors are not people who are obviously bound by the arbitration clause between two parties. And it may well be the court may say, on the facts of this case, the interests of those parties who are not bound by the exclusive arbitration agreement are a relevant consideration, and the court will bear that in mind. What often happens, and this ties in with what Karishma was talking about earlier, is that if you have delayed seeking relief for any reason, the court may well say, well, the delay in itself is a good reason or good enough reason for rejecting the relief that you're seeking. Two other examples, one which is fairly common and the one that is rare and very uncommon. But the common example is voluntary participation in foreign proceedings. So this often happens where you've been sued in a court where you were doing business under a joint venture agreement. Now, for practical considerations, you enter appearance. Now, you enter appearance under protest and say, well, we are not bound by, we are not subject to the jurisdiction of this court, where we are entering appearance. But sometimes you go beyond that and you voluntarily participate in those proceedings. And then if you go to the English court and say, well, actually, we want to enforce the arbitration agreement, the court may well say, well, it's too late and you're now bound to participate or continue participating in proceedings in which you have been participating so far. So your voluntary participation in itself may well be a problem. The rare example, and I just mentioned this because to illustrate the point that there may well be unique circumstances that apply to a case. This is from a case called Sam Purpose from 2017, which proceedings were brought in breach of an arbitration agreement where the purpose of those proceedings was the arrest of a vessel as security for the arbitration claim. Now, we are dealing with a very specific type of shipping dispute, where ultimately the question is, proceedings have been brought to arrest a vessel, which can then be used as security for the arbitration claim. Now, that is a very rare scenario, which doesn't happen frequently, certainly in my practice, and I wouldn't have thought in Karishma's practice either. But those of you watching who do more shipping work may well see this. But the point that I wish to emphasize is that you must look at the circumstances of your case and try and see whether there is any strong reason where you can compel the court, if you are the respondent to an anti-suit injunction application, to say, well, we appreciate that there's an arbitration agreement, but here's good reason X, and you must think strong and hard about it. And if you can satisfy the court, then you may well be in luck. But otherwise, the party seeking an anti-suit injunction has the wind in its sails so far as there's a valid arbitration agreement. So, turning finally to the last slide that I wish to draw to your attention, and there's a checklist of 6 points that I think, whether you're an applicant or respondent, but it's worth bearing them in mind. Firstly, do the foreign legal proceedings fall within the scope of a valid arbitration agreement, which is not void, inoperative, or incapable of being performed? If they do fall within the scope of a valid arbitration agreement, then obviously, as I said, Section 9 gives you a good starting point, and the court does not really have much of, by way of a discretion, if the requirements of Section 9 are met. However, Section 9 is not in itself the end. The court does have a broader jurisdiction, sometimes called its inherent jurisdiction, but also specifically a jurisdiction under Section 37. The second point to consider is the respondent a party to the arbitration agreement and amenable to the jurisdiction of the English court? If it is, then obviously you are good to go. And if it's not, then you have to make a case, try and make a case under the court's inherent jurisdiction and try and persuade the court why. Thirdly, is the court's discretion under Section 37 of the Senior Courts Act to grant an injunction where it is just and convenient to do so engaged? Now, as I said, the discretion is a wide one. It is practically granted unless there are strong reasons against it. And that brings us to the fourth point. Is it likely and the respondent will be able to discharge the burden of proving the strong reasons test for pursuing foreign proceedings within the meaning of Donoghue and associated case law? We've considered and looked at some of the examples of strong reasons, but that was not an exclusive list, and you must look at the circumstances of your case. Fifthly, and this is tied to the strong reasons point, but is an independent enough point in and of itself because it goes to the court's discretion. Has the applicant done something to lose the claim to equitable relief through delay or maybe through unconscionable conduct of its own? And finally, are there any other facts particular to the case which should be taken into account? So those are the points that I think tie together the matters that I have talked about, and hopefully you have found this to be of some use. Thank you very much for watching.
Samar, hi. There was just one point actually that that struck me and that I see quite often in cases that I do, which is when there is an international joint venture agreement or a private equity agreement where an operating company has been incorporated in a particular jurisdiction, let's say that that jurisdiction is not England, what I have seen very frequently is even though the shareholder agreement will tend to say that all disputes and ancillary disputes should go to arbitration, but what tends to happen is one of the shareholders will want to go to the local court where the operating company is incorporated and say, oh, hang on, actually, this is not a matter concerning the shareholder agreement at all. It is a dispute between, inter se, between shareholders or between shareholders and directors of, let's say, a company incorporated in Korea or wherever it may be, or Dubai. And therefore, the local courts should hear this. And it's different. I mean, it's called unfair prejudice in England, but it's called oppression and mismanagement in other Commonwealth jurisdictions and so on. And then the other side would come to the English court and seek an anti-suit injunction in favor of the arbitration agreement. And that really presents, you know, quite a dilemma for the courts, because one of the first things that needs to be decided is whether or not these arguments that are being presented to the local court, wherever the company is incorporated, are they sort of just dressed up arguments, or are they genuine disputes between, you know, shareholders and directors of a foreign company?
Absolutely. And I think that's where it's important to act quickly. Because what you often find in disputes of this sort is that the local court in the country of the operation operational agreement, that local court may or may not be well versed in international arbitration and arbitration agreements. So it is important to act quickly and try and drive through an injunction through the English courts as soon as you can. Because the English court will obviously look at the arbitration agreement. It may well want to be satisfied that the dispute is one that arises under, and in fact, it will want to be satisfied, it is a dispute that arises under the arbitration agreement rather than something to do with the operational company in and of itself. But it highlights the importance of acting quickly and getting all your ducks in a row. The second thing that I will say is that obviously in most, certainly institutional arbitrations, you do have provisions of emergency arbitrators as well. And you can drive through the arbitration process a finding of, we have jurisdiction over this particular dispute and driving through an award. Now, in fact, One of my very first cases on this kind of point was where there was a joint venture party, and the joint venture company had a similar point that, as you raised, in a local court somewhere in Coimbatore had issued certain relief. And we had to, as respondents in the overall claim, we had to drive through a partial award on seat, and then it went all the way through the court systems in India, but we also got released through the arbitration process. So I think your question highlights the importance of A, acting quickly, and B, thinking creatively, so as to say, well, what are the avenues that are open to us?
Yes, how interesting, because while emergency awards are not enforceable because they're not final in nature and they have no finality under the New York Convention, but it's very tactful and strategic to actually have a partial award in your favor, because that does have finality and is enforceable. So very interesting that. But thank you, Samar, and thank you also LexisNexis for having us.